This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm Stan Grant. A little later, why the war on drugs in El Salvador is being cast as a spiritual war.
Not only has Bukele used his social media platforms to showcase sort of the evils and using those exact terms of gangs, but also showing himself in the sort of savior light.
Amy Fallas, a Salvadoran Costa Rican writer, a little later on the program. If World War III was to break out, many say it could start over Taiwan, and we've been reminded of that just this past week after US Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi made a quick visit to the island. China responded with ramped-up military exercises, war games to intimidate Taiwan, which it considers a renegade province. Now, it raises a fascinating ethical question. What does it mean to adopt a strategy of ambiguity? Now, the US, like Australia, recognises only one China, but there is enough wriggle room built into that for all sides to avoid conflict. What happens when that ethical ambiguity fails? And are we seeing that right now? Dr. Roger Lee Huang is expert on Taiwan's security and international relations at Macquarie University.
Yeah, so the strategic ambiguity has really been in existence the last several decades. After the United States recognized the People's Republic of China as the one China, It really gave the space to continue de facto diplomatic relations, really. I mean, everyone calls it unofficial, informal, you know, any word you want to use.
Well, they're not strictly diplomatic, are they? But there are ties, and there is the Taiwan's Relations Act. There is some meat on the bone still to that relationship.
Well, exactly. I mean, anyone who's actually visited Taiwan would recognize that large majority of international community actually has representation of some form, even though they're informal, they're usually called trade or cultural or economic offices. But you go to the de facto embassy in Taipei, it's this massive building that's only been upgraded recently, relocated and upgraded a couple of years ago. So these are all real significant informal but de facto relations that United States, Australia, and other countries have in Taiwan. Now, the strategic ambiguity really have, for one way, try to maintain the so-called status quo since the United States recognized China in 1979, which is to both deter China, of course, to formally invade and annex Taiwan, but at the same time, it was meant to keep Taiwan also from formally declaring de jure formal independence, Republic of Taiwan. So this kind of legal gray area, in many ways, I think, might be past its due date when we're in 2022.
Especially
much more.
Especially, Roger, yes, sorry to come in there, but especially if we see moves like Nancy Pelosi, a very senior figure, visiting Taiwan. Is that an unnecessary provocation? Is that the sort of thing that strategic ambiguity was designed to avoid?
Well, yes and no. I think in many ways, and this is where China has done very well, is to really up the ante itself. So China, you know, what we're looking at the moment, the last several days was a live military exercise. Many of this, sure, the scale hasn't been quite the same in the past, but especially the last 2 years, you have seen from the Chinese side this escalation of tension in several fronts, whether it's trade and economic coercion, which we've also seen here in Australia, of course, but also a large number of POA planes coming over to the air defense zone identification zone in Taiwan areas. So these things have been escalating for the last several years. And in many ways, Pelosi's visit just gives a pretext for China to do much more than what it was able to get away with.
Should the United States, though, Roger, be cognizant of, I know that China has ramped up that rhetoric, it's increased its military exercises, but should the United States be cognizant of the risks of a provocation that may have been unnecessary, that this is the sort of thing that could tip this over the edge?
Yeah, and I think there is a lot of that blame game. Who's to blame? Is it the U.S. unnecessarily provoking China's response? And from my perspective, yes, you know, there could always be more careful ways to really navigate the tricky situation across the Taiwan Strait. But at the same time, the status quo change, this revisionist change, really isn't coming from the United States and Taiwan. The stakeholder that is trying to change what has been basically established de facto, at least since 1979, arguably since 1949, with the establishment of the PRC.
After the Civil War,
after the Civil War, it's actually China that's trying to change the status quo. You know, as a fact, there has been two separate political entities across the strait, at least since 1949. Now, whether we want to formally refer to Taiwan as Taiwan or Republic of China or any other name, Chinese Taipei or any other really funny monkeys, in my opinion, is not the issue. The issue is what China wants to do. There is no actual movement from sensible political leaders in Taiwan to declare DJRA independence because they recognize exactly what you're referring to, this type of supposed provocation of Chinese action. But the fact on the ground is that these are two different political entities.
So Roger, given that, and given that you said maybe we call time on strategic ambiguity, given the increased escalation and pressure that's coming from mainland China, what then? What is the response now? Is this a time to pick sides?
As an academic, I try not to make everything too simple because, of course, it's very complex and nuanced. I do think that strategic ambiguity might be close to pass its due date. I think there needs to be clear red lines to be drawn from a Taiwanese and American side. We often hear about Chinese red line, right? That's what we often hear about, whether it's in the newspapers, headlines, or even within academic debates. But what are the red lines for Taiwan? What are the red lines for the United States? We don't hear them enough. Sure, China has its own political reason to do what it does. And some people argue that it's really beyond strategic calculation, that it's almost a religious kind of belief that they need to unify or annex or whatever you want to call, take Taiwan as part of China. But you need to have firm ground saying, look, the status quo has worked, but China will use military force if it deems that it has the power to overcome any challenges, any international intervention. That is clear. China has not denied that. So what needs to be done? I'm definitely not an advocate for war and further arms race, but the reality on the ground is you need to find a realistic, credible deterrence to prevent China being too overconfident and misfire or make a wrong decision. We don't want to have the day where Xi Jinping decides or any potential CCP leadership waking up in the morning saying, today is the day, I'm sure we can carry out this massive invasion, and Japan and the United States and South Korea and Australia will not be able to stop us. And I think things like Pelosi's visit are important. Yes, might not be the best way to have carried out the trip. There might be other ways to navigate around that trip. But it shouldn't stop these leaders from the international community to come and show its support for Taiwan. And that's really something you can see in Taiwan. For a large majority of people in Taiwan, were very, very welcoming and very happy of the visit. You know, for better or worse, a large majority of Taiwanese do not view the current live military exercise as an imminent threat, as many of the international headlines have suggested.
Just finally, Roger, to what extent, if at all, the Russia-Ukraine war factors in to this? Is China watching this and thinking, well, what will this tell us about an invasion of Taiwan? What will this tell us about American resolve? How does China factor Russia's invasion of Ukraine into its planning for Taiwan?
I mean, everyone clearly is looking at what's unfolding in Ukraine, right? And I think, in my opinion, this has really gave China more careful thought if it does want to indeed carry out a successive campaign. What Ukrainians have demonstrated is that it's not so straightforward. Everyone really predicted and was kind of saying, well, if Russia invaded, Ukrainians will roll over in 2 weeks. That clearly has not materialized. Now, Taiwan has been paying very close attention to this. We have heard people talk about this for a long time, to develop these asymmetrical kind of defensive mechanisms to prevent China from overpowering Taiwan's defense. You're hearing a lot of the Taiwanese civilians themselves now to think of ways to help any potential war effort. So there's been an uptake, apparently, with people joining gun clubs. There's been kind of civilian self-training courses, in case of any actual conflict. Can they do CPR? Where are the airbomb shelters? And all these things are now being seriously re-examined and discussed again not on the Chinese side too, I think they will also see that really any foreign invasion, they need to have absolute certainty, right, that they can quickly take over Taiwan. And if they can't, then this is something they're also not going to be worth going to gamble on. We've already seen the economic repercussions for the entire international community of the invasion of Ukraine. And given China's kind of importance in the global supply chain, everyone will suffer. And I think that's a good lesson for everyone to remember, is that no one wins in war. And I think we need to start thinking about the narrative that China has this right to say and dictate whether someone or the other can or cannot visit Taiwan. And I think visit from 82-year-old politician shouldn't, yes, I know the symbolism, yes, I know she's third, you know, second in line to the presidency, but all of this shouldn't provoke the type of reaction China has, you know, pulled out, all these live armed missile exercises, everything. All of this seems disproportionate to what a simple visit should provoke.
Roger, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Roger Thi Wang, expert on Taiwan security and international relations at Macquarie University in Sydney. Thank you.
Thank you, Stan.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report on RN, and you can find us on the ABC Listen app. In El Salvador, a war against gangs has been described as a spiritual struggle. The president, Nayib Bukele, says this is a battle with satanic forces. El Salvador is a highly Christian country, but Bukele himself has been targeted over religion. His family is Lebanese. His father had embraced Islam. Bukele styles himself as a believer in Jesus, but not belonging to any one faith. Now, faith and law and his presidency have certainly come together. Amy Fallas is a Salvadoran Costa Rican writer. She's completing her PhD in history at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
The war on gangs in El Salvador has been a very notable historic issue since the 80s and 90s, and has been a constant source of focus for every single Salvadoran administration since the 90s, since the post-war settlement. And so the religious dimension comes in very crucially with how a lot of, I would say, even evangelical organizations and churches have tried to address these issues outside of the mano dura policies in El Salvador, so the heavy hand, which is essentially securitization, incarceration. So these are seen as sort of alternative ways of addressing this issue. And now what we're seeing with Bukele is actually something that mirrors that and has gained once again this sort of spiritual dimension, as he has specifically referred to his new policies in addressing the gang violence or gang issues within spiritual terms.
But Bukele's talked about satanic forces, a battle of good and evil. Is this because he identifies that in an overwhelmingly Christian country, that this is going to find fertile ground, that framing it in this way will be popular?
Bukele has had a very interesting way of mobilizing religious identity in order to court lots of different interests while also maintaining control. One of the interesting things that we have seen over the past several months, particularly after the establishment of the state of exception since March, that not only has Bukele used his social media platforms to showcase sort of the evils and using those exact terms of gangs, but also showing himself in the sort of savior light. And this was part of his presidential platform when he ran for the presidency in 2019 and was part of his platform before when he was mayor of San Salvador as well.
And Amy, this state of exception that you mentioned, of course, is aimed at tackling this gang violence. But you're right to identify the appeal to religion, and his own background is fascinating here as well. Someone for whom religion was used against in his run for the presidency, there was some skepticism and wariness about him, wasn't there?
Yes. So this was at the, I would say, center of controversy for Bukele's presidential election, and particularly within the weeks leading up to the election itself. What's interesting about Bukele is he has a very fascinating faith background that is tied to and shaped by his Palestinian roots. So he's this fifth generation Palestinian Salvadoran, descended from Christian migrants who arrived to El Salvador. But his father, who at this point is fourth generation, converts to Islam. And so he is raised within this milieu where he's raised Catholic, but also experienced Islamophobia growing up. And so during the election, this comes up again, where there's a lot of speculation as to whether he is a secret Muslim.
Well, he had played up to this. I was reading when he was at school, he sort of half jokingly or mockingly would refer to himself as the class terrorist and so on. There was an extent that he'd played with this idea, hadn't he?
Absolutely. I think he's always been aware of these politics of religious identity, and he has had to navigate a lot of different identities in a Christian majority nation, and one in which is fairly polarized between, I would say, certainly a Catholic hegemony, but an ascendant evangelical Protestant movement that has been on the rise since the late 70s. So that was definitely an aspect of his own upbringing, and yes, being very conscientious of that. And I think, again, use that and mobilize that in very strategic ways when there was this attack, when he was experiencing this pre-election rumors and speculation, was saying, well, actually, I'm a person of faith and we should be respectful and it's really about conviction.
And of course, Amy, he does talk about faith as being something he doesn't necessarily, while he believes, he doesn't practice any particular religion or belong to anyone. Is that an attempt to appeal more broadly and offset some of this skepticism?
I think what Bukele does with mobilizing and forging a multi-faith identity, he doesn't necessarily disavow religious identity altogether, but just that he does not affiliate exclusively with one community. He's using all of these connections he has to make connections both domestically and internationally to bolster his own legitimacy. And he leverages each identity in different ways depending on the circumstances.
And how does his decision to recognize Bitcoin as legal tender, El Salvador becoming the first country in the world to do so, play into this?
So I see his embrace of cryptocurrency and Bitcoin as legal tender, this particular policy, as an example of a dynamic whereby Bukele uses Bitcoin, sees Bitcoin as a savior of sorts for the pervasive financial and political issues facing El Salvador. Now, this is also one of the main rallying issues for civil society that's really contesting Bukele's rule. You have the press, you have human rights activists, you have different grassroots organizations that were all in the streets protesting almost a year ago. This sort of overwhelming conviction that Bitcoin will be the sort of savior of El Salvador into the future.
Amy, just finally, how popular does he remain?
Bukele still enjoys high approval ratings. I do want to insert an important caveat, though, that he has faced also a lot of pushback and critique, again, from members of the press, social service organizations, even members of the diaspora, which are usually cast as sort of devoted fans of his. But in actuality, he's facing a lot of criticism, particularly around the Bitcoin issue, but also around the state of exception. And a lot of observers, Salvadorans in the diaspora and in the country, have been pointing out this potential since his populist run back in 2019. So it's not a new critique. It hasn't happened just as a result of these policies, but there has been sort of the writing on the wall based on his language that this would be something that would become an issue.
Amy Fallas, thank you again for giving us your time.
Thank you so much.
Amy Fallas, Salvadoran Costa Rican writer completing her PhD in history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She joined us from Cairo. Well, last week, if you tuned in, you would have heard the lauded Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor warn us against the dangers of fraying democracy in a secular world with more and more people, especially in the West, turning away from faiths. What do we agree upon? It also raises questions about identity and whether we can all live in peace with all of our differences. This is part two of my conversation with Charles Taylor. One of the things that you raise, Professor Taylor, is the question of identity. And that seems to be increasingly to the forefront within liberal democracies, but elsewhere as well. What is the sense of identity in our world that people are seeking meaning and often in an exclusionary sense? Me against someone else, us versus them. Identity that grows out of grievance and can often sit at the heart of so much of the conflict in our world. Where does this come from? How does this fit into your malaise of modernity?
This is a very interesting new use of the word identity. If you tried to speak to somebody a century ago about identity in our presence, they wouldn't have understood you.
This is political identity, isn't it?
Not only political identity. It can be personal identity, that sense of identity. I think what this covers is what would be called, let's say, 100 years ago, the fundamental commitments that I have, right? And everybody has such fundamental commitments by which they judge other possible issues that arise for them. It could be a religious one, it could be an atheist one, it could be to do with one's society, one's polity, and so on. Things that are really, really fundamental to me and that I use as a criterion to understand where I want to go when I have the different choices in life. Now, the fact of beginning to use the word identity for that meant a kind of subtle change in the whole idea of what my fundamental beliefs are. The idea is that I have some say. I think it out. It's something that's personally worked out for me. It's not just given to me from outside.
Well, it's the buff itself, isn't it, that you've talked about, the master of their domain, the person that does not want to allow themselves the invulnerabilities. It's no longer porous and open to others.
I don't think that's it, because on the contrary, the desire of people who have this kind of identity is for recognition. Desire is for them to be accepted, right? And if they're not accepted, if this is refused them, they feel precisely a profound malaise. So it's really something that only can arise among not buffered, but porous cells, if you like, to that extent porous. But it is a kind of reliance on others. You can't bring a kid up, right, denying all the time their fundamental intuitions about what they want to do.
It is, Professor Taylor, a desire for recognition, that's true. But it also comes from a rejection of something too, isn't it? It is often a source of recognition for something that was lost. I know you've talked about the importance of ontology, the stories we tell. The stories that we often tell in our world today are a story of the wound, the humiliation, the loss. We see this played out in Vladimir Putin's Russia, where he talks about the collapse of the Soviet Union as the great catastrophe of the 20th century. He sees his war in Ukraine as a war of identity, doesn't he? Whether it's China and talking about the 100 years of humiliation, it is seeking recognition, but it also comes from a sense of wanting to withdraw or respond to something, a rejection almost of modernity, secularism, and what the West represents.
Yeah, you can have an identity built on that, on a rejection of the other, but that's not necessarily the case. Let's look at cases where identity has had a tremendously positive effect. And let's look at the victim of the present Putin offensive, namely Ukraine. I mean, I first visited Ukraine in 91, when they were just after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I was struck by how divided it was then between Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers and how much suspicion there was. And yet they built, partly because of this pressure from Russia, they responded by the development of Ukrainian identity, of mutual recognition. So it's not always an issue of exclusion. It sometimes is, but the great moments are the moments when people develop a common identity which really speaks to their individual identities. And they do that because they build it together. And this is something quite remarkable and quite inspiring.
Just coming to that source of conflict and the tension that exists in our world, and I'm just wanting to get your thoughts on what will define this age. What is the future of a liberal, secular, a democratic West where, as you pointed out, there is often a sense of emptiness, alienation. You've described a terrifying emptiness vis-a-vis the rise of authoritarian states, China, Russia, that talk about a sense of purpose, stability, as they would see it. In this tussle right now, who has the upper hand? Who is more likely to prevail? Can the West regather itself, find its strength from this malaise? Or is authoritarianism a viable alternative?
Well, it's not a viable alternative everywhere. That's the first thing to say, that outside certain societies that seem to have, at the moment, a total control, and even they, not necessarily always, authoritarianism will always breed enemies, will always breed dissatisfaction. So that certainly isn't a stable solution. But maybe we haven't got a stable solution either. And where would it come from? Well, I'll tell you where it could come from. If you look at a lot of young people today, it's very interesting because unlike their elders, they don't see difference in identity as a threat. They see difference in identity as an opportunity, as a possibility. They feel enriched by associating with people of very different backgrounds and different outlooks. And that sense of enrichment makes them, on the contrary, passionate supporters of this kind of, if you like, diverse democracy. So I'm thinking of the murder of George Floyd, that the Black Lives Matter movements that obviously that stirred up right away were different from the earlier ones because in the demonstrations, there were a lot of non-Blacks supporting the idea of Black Lives Matter. And if you go to the younger generation in the United States or in Canada, for that matter, you see that there's a possibility of a way out of all this in the very outlook of younger people that, if you like, diversity is a source of enrichment, not a source of danger. If we can tap those feelings, those reactions among younger people, if we can hang in long enough, there's a possible way out here. And that's all it is, the possible way out, but it's a direction in which our politics can go.
And Professor Taylor, I wanted to finish where we began, really, and that is around the idea of faith, the idea of God, of religion in this world. You are a person of faith and someone who wrestles with that and its role in our world. If we're looking for a revival in the West, strengthening of those social bonds, what role does religion have in that? What role does it have in the public space? And do the rights of religion have to be protected in that public space?
The point is that we're now in a situation where not just religious forms of spiritual growth, but any form needs that kind of protection. It needs a protection against discrimination. It's being identified as something which is dangerous and unacceptable and so on. So they all need that kind of protection. But you could imagine that these different paths, some obviously religious, some not so obviously religious or religion-like, could come together in a sense of having a common purpose, a common ethic. It's exactly what happened in the Ukrainian case, again, if you like, taking the fact that there are churches connected to the Catholic Church in Ukraine, there are churches connected to the Moscow Patriarchate, to the Patriarchate in Constantinople, and so on. So there were all these differences within Ukraine before, too, and they exist still, but they have a sense of common task to build a really civilized, open, equal society together. So religions are going to play a very, very important role in this, either in the good direction or in the bad direction, the way Putin is leading the Russian Orthodox Church, or Kirill, the present patriarch, incidentally with the condemnation of all the other Orthodox churches in the world. But nevertheless, they can play a very destructive role, but they can play a very positive role. Indeed, positive role is indispensable if we're going to get through this difficult period.
Charles Taylor, it's been an absolute pleasure to spend time with you. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you.
And you can catch part one of my discussion with Charles Taylor, renowned philosopher, emeritus professor at McGill University in Canada, on our website. And that's it for the Religion and Ethics Report for this week. I'm Stan Grant. I want to thank Hong Jiang and Simon Branthwaite. And you can catch us again next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.